Well, good morning to all of you. Thanks for coming out today and being a part of this. I'm grateful for your presence here, and it's certainly a pleasure to be at First Pres. I've had a chance to get to know a lot of folks here over the years, certainly know Derek Thomas for many years in the Reformed Theological Seminary world. Mark mentioned that he was a student of mine years ago. I won't tell you any embarrassing stories about Mark, although he's probably wondering if I'm going to do that today. But it is great to be with you here at First Pres. A beautiful day and a great chance to discuss the topics before us today. I want to take some time just to introduce what we're going to talk about today. I know that I've been invited to participate in a very interesting lecture series on the book of Judges called the Thornwell Lectures. That's a real honor to be a part of that today. I've got to confess from the outset, though, I'm going to cheat a little as we get going in the series here, and I trust you'll forgive me for that. I know the series is on the book of Judges, but I'm going to use that more as a launching pad into an entirely different topic related to the theme of Judges, but distinctive as well. We're going to talk this morning about something unrelated to the book, but I think related to your life, and that is this topic of hidden gospels. Or another way to put it, as the subtitle of my talk you may have seen mentioned various places, this quest our world has to rewrite the story of Jesus and to do it by using these alternative stories of Jesus we find in the historical world. That is my topic today, and it's a little off topic of the series, but I think it is relevant because the series is really about people doing what is right in their own eyes. And that's very much what is going on in the historical world today with this quest regarding these lost gospels. So I hope you'll stick with me to stay on this topic. I think it'll be a fascinating one and a relevant one for you. In order to begin that topic, let me take us to my starting point today with a little bit of a backstory on these lost gospels. I want to start by talking about Muhammad Ali. Now, you're thinking to yourself this morning, Muhammad Ali, what in the world does the boxer have to do with lost gospels? What in the world does a boxer have to do with anything we're going to be talking about today? But actually, I'm not talking about the boxer. I'm actually talking about Muhammad Ali, the shepherd, which is probably a person you've never heard of before. Muhammad Ali was a shepherd, actually, in 1945 in Egypt in a place called Nag Hammadi. And in that particular juncture, something very special happened at the time that the world didn't even know about. Something very unique historically took place. Of course, at 1945, the world was thinking of very different things at that point. They were thinking about, of course, the end of World War II. Many things were happening in Europe. Many things were happening in the Pacific Theater. Not many people were paying attention to what a shepherd named Muhammad Ali was doing in 1945. But that day, with his brother, who was also a shepherd, named Sharif Ali, they started to dig in their field. And when they did, they hit something with their shovel. And they thought, what in the world is this? So they began to uncover it, and they found buried beneath the dirt a jar, a fairly sizable clay jar that was sealed at the top. And Muhammad Ali asked his brother, what do you think we should do? Should we open it? And his brother said, no, there might be a genie inside who might curse us. True story. But they debated it back and forth and finally decided there might be something in here really valuable. So they broke it open. And what did they find inside? They found books. Grandly disappointed they were, hoping to find gold. They just simply found books. And at the time had no idea how important they would be in the study of Jesus. Because what they found were codices, 52 treatises about Jesus. But these treatises were different than anything you and I have ever read. These treatises were books outside the New Testament canon. These were books that were about Jesus written by a group called Gnostics who had a very different version of Christianity that you and I know. And in that collection of books is one of the most famous books discovered in the last 100 years, known as the Gospel of Thomas. Muhammad Ali, of course, didn't know what he had found, but that particular discovery changed the course of New Testament and historical studies in a major and dramatic way. And of course, when scholars got a hold of this Gospel of Thomas and these alternate stories of Jesus, you know the questions they begin to ask are the very questions that you and I ask all the time. And that is, well, what about these books? Why don't these get put in the New Testament canon? Why can't these tell us something reliable about Jesus? Maybe the stories of Jesus in these books is actually true, and the stories of Jesus in the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, those aren't true. Maybe that's what we should conclude from this find. And so there began a great debate about what to do with these hidden gospels that are discovered. and more importantly, what to do with the different version of Jesus they contain. Now, lest you think this is some discussion that happens only in the academic halls and in places where scholars have nothing better to do but think about such things, this is the sort of thing that has whittled its way down to the average person in the pew today. No doubt you've heard of the Gospel of Thomas. No doubt you read articles in Newsweek or Time magazine about the latest discoveries. And our culture is always pushing us to rethink the story of Jesus on the basis of these texts. So how do we deal with this? How do we respond to this? Well, that's the topic of my lecture today. I want us to talk about how we deal with this theme of hidden gospels, of alternate stories of Jesus. Do we really have a reason to trust Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, or in fact, the books that belong in the New Testament? That's the topic for us today. And it very much does connect with this theme in Judges, because as you'll see in a moment, what's driving this quest for alternative gospels is a desire for people to do what is right in their own eyes. And they look for these alternate gospels to justify their beliefs. So let's dive in this morning into this topic. And I really want to break our time down into two parts. First, I want to bore a little bit deeper into our culture's sort of quest for Jesus and their fascination with lost gospels and sort of explore that a little bit. And then secondly, I want to give you a little bit of a case for why Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are really the books that belong in our New Testaments. So let's begin with that first point, our culture's fascination with lost gospels. Why the interest? Why is it that when a book is discovered in Egypt in 1945, people are so drawn to it? Well, there's a word that keeps popping up again and again in our culture, and believe it or not, it's made its way to the academy, and that word is diversity. Our culture is fascinated and committed to diversity. No doubt you've seen it over the last 20 years take a real high place in our world. There's an emphasis on diversity of all types, diversity of cultures, diversity of nations, diversity of religions, diversity of philosophies, diversity of views on ethics and morals and marriage and beyond. Our culture is a culture that celebrates diversity. In fact, our culture not only acknowledges diversity, that it exists, and of course no one disputes that it exists, but our culture reaches a conclusion on the basis of that diversity, and that conclusion is one that you hear all the time. Because of diversity, therefore, no one view could be right. No one view could possibly be true, because look at all these people that disagree. Look at all these people with different perspectives. Who are you to tell someone else they're wrong and that you're the one that's right? And so therefore, diversity has become the playing card of our culture. Why? Because it leads them to where they really want to go, which is a declaration that no one view, no one religious system can possibly be right. Just let everyone do what is right in their own eyes. Sounds a lot like the book of Judges. In fact, that's very much what's going on in our culture today, is that everyone is doing exactly what they see as right in their own eyes. There's no one right view based on this diversity, this difference of opinion. Now, that is a theme that's resounding in our culture today, but here's the thing you may not realize, is that that theme has made its way into the historical study of Jesus. People are talking about Jesus in the same themes of diversity and differences of opinion. In fact, I wrote my book, The Heresy of Orthodoxy, on this exact issue, which is now New Testament scholars are looking back into the history of early Christianity and they're seeing it through the lens of diversity. Now, this particular move, if you will, in the academy began a number of years ago in 1934 with a scholar by the name of Walter Bauer in Germany. Now, believe it or not, in Germany in 1934, no one was thinking about what Walter Bauer was writing, of course. In 1934 in Germany, there was a lot of other things going on historically as Hitler was rising to power and things were moving along in Europe in some unfortunate ways. But behind the scenes, Walter Bauer, a German scholar in 1934, wrote a very famous book called Orthodoxy and Heresy in Earliest Christianity. And his theme was simple. It's a complicated book, but his theme was simple. It's simply this: Christianity, in its earliest stages, was much more diverse than you think. In fact, Bauer's thesis was that when you look into early Christianity, it was massively diverse. It was all kinds of different views. No one agreed on much of anything. Everyone was arguing and fighting, and no one got along. And there was this faction and this sect, and they're always arguing against each other to try to figure out who has the real version of Jesus. Some say they're right. Others say they're right. They disagree on salvation. They disagree on Christology. They disagree on soteriology. They disagree on eschatology. They disagree just about everything, says Walter Bauer. What you have in early Christianity is a gargantuan mess. Everyone is arguing, everyone is fighting. In other words, in the earliest stages of Christianity, says Bauer, there was no Christianity. There were Christianities, plural. And it was these multiple versions of Christianity that were going on in this particular time period. Who's to say, said Bauer, that the Christianity that you believe now is the right one? In fact, the Christianity you believe now, says Bauer, is just the group that won these theological battles. They're just the victors of the theological wars that happened in the earliest faith that you know nothing about. But what if another group had won? What if another group had won? Then the thing you call Christianity wouldn't look at all like Christianity, said Bauer. It would look like something entirely different. For example, what if the Gnostics won? Now, you may not even know the term Gnosticism, but Gnostics were an early Christian heresy. Of course, we call it heresy. Bauer says, why would you call it heresy? Who knows? Maybe they're right. But early Christian Gnostics had a very different version of Christianity than you and I know. In our understanding of Christianity, salvation is something that is done for us, external to us, based on the finished work of Christ. But according to Gnostics, that's not true at all. According to Gnostics, salvation is not something outside of you. According to Gnostics, salvation is something inside of you. It's not just that Jesus is divine according to Gnostics. You're divine according to the Gnostics. There's a spark of divinity in each one of us. And if we just gain enlightenment, and if we just come to understand our true selves, that's where salvation is. It's almost like an Eastern religion according to Gnostics. And Bauer comes along the scene and says, well, what if that Christianity had won? You would have a very different version of the faith today than the one you have. Now, Bauer wrote this in 1934, and it sat silent for many, many years. Why? Because our culture wasn't ready to embrace what Bauer had written. But then in 1971, his book was translated into English, and suddenly everything erupted. And here's what's going on in the academy today, is that people like Bauer and those who followed his suit have basically argued that earliest Christianity was wildly diverse, no one agreed on anything, and here's the big punchline. Because there were multiple Christianities, there were multiple Gospels. Every Christian group had its own story of Jesus. Every Christian group had its own Gospel. So not only do you have the Gospel of Thomas representing the Gnostics, you have the Gospel of Peter representing the Docetists, you have the Gospel of Mary representing another sect of Gnosticism, you have the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Truth, you've got all kinds of different Gospels circulating in early Christianity, each representing their own faction, and Bauer, in his writings, and modern scholars today are looking at you and me as Christians and saying, what about these Gospels? Aren't these just as valid? Aren't these just as legitimate? Aren't these simply another alternative version of Jesus that we should give credibility to? Why is your story of Jesus better than theirs? Now, all of this has a real big payoff in our modern culture, and it's simply this. If you can have alternate stories of Jesus, and you can have hidden gospels that you've discovered that represent alternate versions of Christianity, then guess what? You get to pick the one you like the most. And this is where we really circle back around to the theme in Judges. The reason our culture is so fascinated with lost gospels is because it allows them to have the Jesus they prefer. If you don't like the Jesus in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, well, by golly, you can find a different Jesus out there. Just look around. Maybe you like the Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas, or the Gospel of Mary, or the Gospel of Peter. Maybe that's the Jesus that fits the way you believe. And so our culture basically likes lost gospels because it offers a choice. It offers diversity. It's a smorgasbord. Pick the Jesus you like. If you don't like the Jesus of biblical Christianity, then just pick a new Jesus amongst these all other Gospels. And that's exactly what's happening in our world today. The diversity issue, the doing what's right in your own eyes, has made its way into the academy, and it's made its way into this issue of lost Gospels, and that is affecting your neighbor and your coworker and your friends and your family members and the people you interact with in society, and then they learn that you're a Christian, and then they come to you and say, well, why should I believe in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Why not the Gospel of Thomas? And the question for us this morning is, what is our answer? Well, that's, of course, the whole reason that we're here today in this lecture, is I want to help you be able to give an answer. Our first sort of heading here in our time together is this understanding of why our culture is fascinated with lost gospels, and we've just looked at that. But now I want to transition into a second major heading today, and that is our response. Do we have one? What is unique, after all, about Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? Is there anything about these gospels that sets them apart from, say, the Gospel of Peter or the Gospel of Thomas? Absolutely, there is. So what I want to do in our remaining time today is to give you some what I might call talking points. Four, in fact. These are four talking points that tell us what is unique about the canonical Gospels. Why is it that they're in our canons, or in our canon, and not other Gospels? Or to put it another way, what are you going to say to your non-Christian friend when they ask you why you think these are the best sources for the life of Jesus? So let's jump into these four things. And I actually think these four things are very basic. They're actually very simple. They're not all that complicated. Now, you may come up to me after the lecture and say, well, you said they weren't complicated, but they were, right? You may disagree with me at that particular time. But I really think these are basic concepts that just about anybody can grasp and that you can explain to your friends. So let's jump into the very first reason why the canonical Gospels belong in our New Testaments as opposed to these hidden or lost Gospels. First, the canonical Gospels are the earliest Gospels that we have. The canonical Gospels are the earliest Gospels that we have. Here's an amazing fact. Here's a very simple fact. If you ask the question, what are the oldest Gospels? What are the earliest Gospels? What are the Gospels that get us back as far as we possibly can go towards the life of Jesus? Which take us further? Which take us deeper into the first century? Which are the ones that have the greatest claim to antiquity? There's only one answer to that question, and that is, amazingly, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They are the earliest Gospels we possess, and here's a stunning fact. Virtually every scholar in the world agrees about this. You know, scholars don't agree about many things in the world of biblical studies, I can tell you that. There's very few things that are what you could call a consensus, but this is one of them. Almost everyone agrees, and there's a few exceptions I'll tell you in a moment, but almost everyone agrees that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John date to the first century, and they're the only ones that date to the first century. Now, the dates of the individual Gospels we won't get into today, but they range anywhere from 50 A.D. to 90 A.D., depending whether you're talking about the Gospel of Mark or the Gospel of John. But all of them are first century Gospels, and they're the only Gospels that we have that take us back to the first century, the very century Jesus lived in. What about apocryphal Gospels? I use that term apocryphal, by the way. The term apocryphal is just a word that means hidden. It just is referring to Gospels not inside our New Testaments. Lost Gospels, so to speak. What about the apocryphal or lost Gospels? Are they that old? Can they be dated to the first century? The answer is absolutely not. In fact, here's an amazing fact. In modern scholarship, there's a massive unanimity on this fact that every single one of these alternate Gospels, every one of them, is all dated to the second century or later. None of them are as old as the canonical Gospels. None of them go back as early as the canonical Gospels. All of them are second century or later, and many are much later. In fact, we have a number of apocryphal Gospels. We know there are third or fourth century Gospels for a lot of reasons. We know this. We won't go into those today. The only Gospel that's ever been attempted to stick into the first century is the Gospel of Thomas, that Gospel that was discovered by our shepherd friend Muhammad Ali, we discussed just a moment ago. Occasionally you'll find a scholar that gets up the gumption to try to stick the Gospel of Thomas in the first century, and every once in a while someone will try it, and it almost always meets the same fate, which is the scholarly community rejects it. The only Gospels that take us back to the first century remain Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Now, what are the implications of that? Let's think about that for a moment, this first point. The implications are very important. First of all, there's just a scholarly rule of thumb out there that historical documents that are closest to the events they purport to record are going to most likely be the reliable ones. I'll say that again. In the scholarly world, there's a general rule of thumb out there is that documents that purport to record a historical event and are written as close to that event as possible, and those who are written closest to that event are most likely the documents that you can trust the most. And that's exactly what we have with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They get us closer to Jesus than any other Gospels. No other Gospels get us that close. And that historical rule of thumb suggests those are the ones that are going to be the most reliable. In other words, maybe the early church had a reason for settling on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, because they were the ones that got us as far back as we could to the historical Jesus. I mean, think about it for a moment. What if someone wrote a Gospel, let's say, in the 5th century? You could do that, right? And actually, people did. You could write a Gospel in the 5th century, and you may even get some things right. But if you had a choice between a Gospel in the 5th century and a gospel in the first century, which would you pick? Historically speaking, there's really no debate about that. The closer you are to the event you're trying to record, the more reliable your book's going to be. But there's a second implication, though, from the dating of the Gospels. And this is something that people often don't even think about, but it's very, very important. When the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, were written, they were written when there were still people around who were eyewitnesses to these things. They were written at a time when there were still people alive who saw these things. Now, that particular fact has tremendous implications about what you can, quote-unquote, get away with when you write in the ancient world. I mean, can you imagine writing at a time when there were still eyewitnesses around who could either say, yes, that's the way it was, or no, that's not the way it happened? They could either confirm or deny your historical account. What traction would you get for your historical account if you're just making things up? What traction would you get if you just made up Roman rulers and Roman governors and Roman leaders when everybody around who's still alive, who was there, knows those people weren't the Roman governors or leaders that you say were in play? That is a very dangerous thing to do in historical documents. There's no reason to think these four Gospels would have had any credibility in the first century if they weren't consistent with what really happened, given the fact that they're written at a time when eyewitnesses could either confirm or deny such things. Now, you might think, well, no one in the ancient world paid attention to such stuff. No one really cared about historical texts. No one was that careful. Well, that's not true. You may not realize it, but we actually have tremendous evidence that even in the ancient world, even in the first century, there were debates among ancient historians about how to do history. And they would often critique each other's histories. They critique each other's writings and say, that was a lousy historical account. You did a poor job. You didn't interview any eyewitnesses. These sorts of things happen in the ancient world. There's no reason to think the Gospels would have had any luck at all if, in fact, they were making things up in the first century. What that means is if these Gospels are dated to the first century, they're written at a very crucial time when eyewitnesses were still around who could either confirm or deny what was in them. That fact alone will get you a lot of headway in your conversations with your non-Christian friends. I imagine that most of your non-Christian friends probably don't even know that fact, but you just simply say, do you know that the canonical Gospels are the earliest we have? And that basically everyone agrees on that fact. Let me mention now a second talking point as you think about what makes the canonical Gospels unique. First was that they're the earliest we have. Second, the canonical Gospels have a credible connection to the apostles. The canonical Gospels have a credible connection to the apostles. You know, when you think about what would make a gospel attractive in the ancient world, it's not just that it would be first century. That would be nice, and we have that. But what would make a gospel particularly attractive, it was written by someone who actually saw those things happen. Now, it could be written in the first century and not be written by someone who saw those things happen or who got his information from someone who saw those things happen, but that's exactly what you'd want. If you want a reliable gospel, you want a gospel from one of Jesus' companions. You want a gospel from one of the inner circle. You want a gospel from someone who actually participated, who actually witnessed these things, who was there, who saw them, who saw the water turn into wine, who saw the feeding of the 5,000, that saw Lazarus raised from the dead, who saw Jesus alive again after he was raised from the dead. You want someone who was hands-on, boots-on-the-ground type of eyewitness, and that's what the apostles were. The apostles, of course, just different terminology. The apostles, really, another term for the disciples, the 12 that were sent out by Jesus with a mission to proclaim the good news. Those are the people that were the key players in early Christianity because they were the ones that were there to witness things happening. Wow, if you could get a gospel by one of those guys or one of their companions, that would mean a lot. But of course, here we come to the nub of it. Only the canonical gospels have any credible chance of being written by apostles or their companions. In fact, we say as Christians that it's more than a chance. We believe they actually were written by those individuals. But if you look at it just from a historical perspective, only the canonical gospels have any shot at all of being written by apostles. Now, when it comes to authorship issues, that's a complicated question. We can't go into, in one lecture in a morning like this, sort of how we know books were written by the names attached to them. I just want to give you an example of one way we know this. Take, for example, the Gospel of John. How do we know that John wrote John? How do we know someone didn't just slap a name on there and say it's from John, just like someone put a name on Thomas? Well, here's where you learn that there's different historical data that can help you know who wrote a gospel. One of those pieces is the testimony of the earliest Christians, the testimony of the church fathers. And we have a lot of testimony about the authorship of John, but I'll mention one, and that's a guy by the name of Irenaeus. Irenaeus was a second century church father, very prominent, who tells us in his writings very explicitly that the gospel that bears the name of John was written by the apostle John, the one who was right there with Jesus. Now, do we have any reason to think Irenaeus would know such things? I mean, where would Irenaeus get that information from? Well, here's what's interesting. When you look at Irenaeus's work, he gets almost all this kind of information from a guy by the name of Polycarp, who was an earlier church father, a bishop before Irenaeus. Where did Polycarp get his information from? Here's the stunning fact, is that he got it directly from John himself. Polycarp was a disciple of the Apostle John, and Irenaeus was a disciple of Polycarp. Irenaeus says that John wrote John, and he's only one person removed from John himself. One. Now, in historical terms, that is stunning. I can tell you there's all kinds of things that we believe are facts in history that have nowhere near the level of credibility that that testimony would have. But Irenaeus knows the guy that knows John. And yet he tells us that this is the guy who wrote this book. What is the chance of him getting that wrong? What is the chance of him making it up? What is the chance that he's a fraud? Well, there's a chance for all those things. Irenaeus isn't infallible. But historically speaking, we have every good reason to think that John wrote the book that bears his name. And we could go on and on with Matthew, Mark, and Luke and make the same sort of case. But here's the end of the day. At the end of the day, we have gospels that were not just for a century. We have gospels that actually have a credible connection to being eyewitness texts. What about the apocryphal gospels? Do they have the same credibility? Well, no, not at all. We've already talked about their date, right? All second century and later. That alone tells you they couldn't be written by apostles or anybody connected with the apostles. They're too late. They're latecomers to the game. They're written in second, third, and fourth century. They can't possibly be giving you the same kind of testimony that Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John are giving us. They're too much after the fact. Now, people will come back and say, but they have the names of apostles attached to them. But yes, that's precisely true. They do have names attached to them that are names of apostles. But that's exactly what they would do in the ancient world when they would try to write a book after the fact and give it some credibility. I mean, think about it for a moment. If you're writing a gospel in the second or third century and you wanted to give it a hearing, what would you name it? You wouldn't call it Bob's Gospel, right? No one would pay attention to that. But you might call it Peter's Gospel. Or Thomas's? Or Philip's? Here's the thing. The fact that apocryphal gospels have the name of apostles, don't let that fool you. That's just them mimicking the four that we already had at that point, trying to give their new ones a hearing. In fact, it's interesting, you could see how this game is played out in the early church. Some were so aggressive in naming their false gospels that some of them even named their false gospel the Gospel of the Twelve. They're saying, I got a gospel that's written by all 12 apostles, right? I can play that game. But at the end of the day, none of these apocryphal texts have any credible basis for their titles. Why? Because they're all late to the game. Now, if that's true, then our canonical gospels are in a very special place. Because not only are they first century testimony, but they're eyewitness testimony. And I would add to that that they're authoritative eyewitness testimony, because it wasn't just the apostles were there. The apostles spoke for Jesus with his authority. He commissioned them to speak for him. He gave them his authority to speak on his behalf. They were his mouthpiece. Now, if you want to know what Jesus was really like, you don't only need a gospel that takes you to that century. You need a gospel that takes you into his inner circle. And that's exactly what Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John did, and that's exactly what the apocryphal gospels do not do. It makes you begin to think, well, maybe the early church had a reason. Maybe they were right about why these four were unique. That leads us to a third fact this morning that I think you could put down in your talking points for what is unique about the canonical gospels, and that is, thirdly, the canonical gospels lack the legendary embellishments of later gospels. Now, here's an interesting thing to consider when it comes to the study of apocryphal gospels. And that is, most people have never read an apocryphal gospel. And they don't realize how different they sound and how bizarre many of them are and how embellished and strange they often are in when we read them. And there's a reason for that, and that is most people just don't have any familiarity with them. They have heard about them. They read magazine articles about them, but they've never actually read an apocryphal gospel. In fact, let's just take a little straw poll this morning. How many of you, not just having heard, but I wonder how many of you have read, actually read, the Gospel of Peter? Okay, I see one hand. Now, don't tackle that guy after the service today and think there's something wrong with him. He's probably read it in a class somewhere. All right, let me do another thing. I'll probably get more hands on this. How many of you have actually read, not just heard about, but actually read the Gospel of Thomas? Okay, I got maybe 8 to 10 hands there. What does that tell us? That tells us the average Joe out there, your neighbor, for example, has never read these books and has no idea how different they are. But here's an interesting thing about them, is that when you read them and you compare them to the canonical Gospels, some massive differences stand out in terms of the way they're written. When we look at the canonical Gospels, one of the things we find is that they speak in a very restrained and matter-of-fact way. You ever notice that when you read the canonical Gospels, how sort of straightforward, almost like they're telling you a news story when you read them? Almost to some extent, oddly detached. Without the emotion or the embellishment sort of added facts around it that might make you think this person's got too much of a vested interest here. Rather, the canonical Gospels are amazingly restrained in what they tell us about. Not just in the way they describe things, but also the things they leave out. Let me give you an example of this. You ever notice how when you read the canonical Gospels and the stories of the resurrection, you ever notice how that when you read about the resurrection, you never actually see it happening in the canonical Gospels? You ever thought about that? When you read the story of the resurrection, you don't actually get an account of it happening. All you get an account of is it after the fact. You show up after the fact and it's already taking place. Now, if you wrote a gospel and you were making things up and you wanted to tell the story of the resurrection, don't you think you might want to include what it looked like when it really took place? This is an example of the restrained nature of the canonical Gospels. I'll give you a second example. How about Jesus as a child? Ever wonder what Jesus was like as a child? The canonical Gospels are very thin on this point. In fact, they only have one story, right? The story of Jesus as a boy in the temple in the Gospel of Luke is the only one we have. But you can imagine how your imagination might run away with you. What was it like to have Jesus as a child? What would it be like to be Jesus' brothers and sisters and to grow up with him? I wonder how many times they heard, "Why can't you be more like your brother Jesus," right? We might think to ourselves, what in the world would it be like to have a boy son of God? But the Gospels of the New Testament are restrained. They're silent. They don't lack the embellishment on these key points we might want them to fill in. In other words, they don't do what you might want them to do. But when we turn to the apocryphal Gospels, we see a very different flavor. In fact, we see massive embellishments, all kinds of crazy and bizarre things. And here's the key thing we see in many of these apocryphal Gospels. We see them filling in the gaps left by the canonical ones. By the way, that alone tells you about the date of these Gospels. If they're, in one sense, reacting to the canonical Gospels and filling in the gaps left by the canonical Gospels, then you already realize that they're doing something after the canonical Gospels were written, in response to them, in fact. I'll give you a couple examples of this kind of embellishment in the ancient world that I think will probably help you understand what we're talking about. And the first is the infancy Gospel of Thomas. The infancy Gospel of Thomas, not to be confused with the Gospel of Thomas, is exactly the kind of gospel I mentioned a moment ago that did fill in the gaps about the stories of Jesus as a child. You want to know what Jesus was like as a child, and you want to be terrified about it, go read the infancy Gospel of Thomas later today, and that will be an amazing experience for you, because the infancy Gospel of Thomas presents Jesus as a boy, but he's not at all like you expect. He's probably more like Damien than he is the Son of God. He's this terrifying little sort of hellion of a child going around zapping people dead who get in his way. There's a story in the infancy Gospel of Thomas where another child bumps into the child Jesus, and he kills him on the spot. And then, of course, he raises him from the dead right after that, just to make sure that he's back alive again. There's another story in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas where the boy Jesus is building these little clay birds or clay pigeons on the Sabbath day and thereby breaking the Sabbath. And when he's challenged by the village leaders, he turns these clay pigeons into real pigeons and the evidence flies away. And everyone is living in terrified fear of this little boy Jesus in the Infancy Gospel of Thomas. And you realize, wow, this is strange stuff. This is bizarre. This is nothing like what we would read in the canonical Gospels. I'll give you a second example of this type of embellishment. Even more bizarre is the Gospel of Peter. If you want to read an account of the resurrection actually happening, the Gospel of Peter gives it to you. The Gospel of Peter wasn't, of course, written by Peter. It's a probably mid-second century production, just like the Gospel of Thomas. But it actually shows you the resurrection happening. You want to know what it's like? Well, you can read about it later, but here's what happens. Jesus emerges from his tomb, and Peter has the camera rolling, so to speak. And as Jesus comes out of the tomb, you think, okay, well, that's nothing wrong with that. It's just Jesus coming out of his tomb. But in the Gospel of Peter, it's not a normal Jesus coming out of the tomb. He's a giant Jesus. He's a 60-foot Jesus. He's a Jesus, the text tells us, whose head reaches the clouds. He's flanked on each side by two angels. And as he comes out of the tomb, he's giant, way up in the sky. And you think, well, that's bizarre enough. So I've got a sort of disembodied giant Jesus coming out of the tomb. And there's a theological reason for that, by the way. Gospel of Peter is docetic, which is a whole group that denies the physicality of Jesus. But nonetheless, you have this giant Jesus emerging from the tomb, flanked by angels. And then, secondly, bizarrely, coming out of the tomb after Jesus is the cross itself. Following Jesus out of the tomb. Now, no one tells us how the cross got in the tomb, but also the text doesn't tell us how is the cross following Jesus. Presumably, it's floating behind Jesus. It doesn't have any legs. I mean, the cross isn't walking. So the cross is, I guess, floating behind giant Jesus as he comes out of the tomb. But then it gets even more bizarre because then the cross starts to talk. So now you've got a giant 60-foot sort of Godzilla Jesus coming out of the tomb with a floating, talking cross behind it. What do you do with stuff like that? Well, truth be told, people need to read that. You need to ask yourself, look, when you talk about why the church settled on Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, one of those reasons is this legendary embellishment we so often find in apocryphal texts that sets them apart. Now, that leads us to the fourth bullet point here. So far, we've looked at three. The canonical Gospels are the earliest we have. Secondly, the canonical Gospels have a credible connection to the apostles. Thirdly, the canonical Gospels lack the legendary embellishments of later Gospels. And then fourth and finally, the canonical Gospels were recognized by the church at a very early time. You know, there's a claim out there by modern scholars that the apocryphal Gospels in early Christianity were just as popular as the canonical ones. Yeah, sure, people were reading Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, but they're also reading Thomas and Peter and Mary and Philip just as much. Everything was a level playing field. All these Gospels were equally popular. The problem with that story that you hear all the time in the media is it's simply false. In fact, when you look at the actual historical accounts in the early church, it's not at all the case that these apocryphal Gospels were equally popular with the canonical ones. In fact, as far back as we can see, the Gospels the church affirmed were just these four: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Irenaeus, when you asked him how many Gospels, he said four. Our earliest canonical list, called the Muratorian Canon or the Muratorian Fragment, four. Clement of Alexandria, how many Gospels did he have? Four. Here's a stunning fact for you to know. There was never really any controversy in the early church over which Gospels to read. There was never any real substantive debate. There was never any council that argued it out and voted, like so much of the internet lore will tell you. In fact, so dominant were the canonical four at such an early point that if you'd lived in the second century and stuck a microphone in someone's face and asked the question, why did you choose Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? They would probably look at you strangely and go, what are you talking about, choose? We didn't choose Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's not like we were looking for Gospels out there and called a council and said, well, let's pick some Gospels, even though that's the popular idea behind it. Rather, they would probably say to you, these were just the ones that were handed down to us. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Here's a curious fact. When we turn to the apocryphal Gospels in the early church, we're told they're so popular, but the evidence is against it at every point. I'll give you a few instances of this. One of the things we find in early Christianity is canonical lists that list which books the church receives. We have many, many of these. Every time the Gospels are listed, never, ever do we find apocryphal Gospels listed with canonical ones. Ever. We don't ever see a list that says Matthew, Mark, and Thomas. We never see a list that says Matthew, Luke, John, and Philip. Ever. Every time you see a canonical list, what is it? It's Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. A second example of this is that in the early church, we actually find manuscripts of Gospels bound together in what are called codices. In fact, we usually find codices with multiple Gospels in them joined together in the same book. Here's a fascinating fact. Do we find any of these composite codices with multiple Gospels? Do we ever find a situation where apocryphal Gospels are inside there along with canonical ones or what we now call canonical ones? The answer is never. We don't find a single codex anywhere where it's Matthew, Mark, and Thomas, or Matthew, Luke, and the Gospel of Mary, or something like this. That never, ever happens. Whenever we find Gospels combined in a single book, it's always Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But there's another thing that's interesting when you look at early Christianity that allows you to gauge popularity of books, and that is the extant manuscripts they leave behind in terms of numbers. Here's the thing that's interesting about archaeology, and particularly the study of ancient manuscripts, which I've spent a lot of time looking at, is that there is a way to calculate, of course, the number of manuscripts that books leave in the ancient world, and that is an indicator of how popular they were, because it tells you how much they were copied and how much they were read. In other words, if you find a lot of manuscripts of a book, there's a good indication it was widely used. If you find very few manuscripts of a book, there's a very good indication there that it's probably not widely used. When you look at the canonical Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, it is stunning to see how many manuscripts we have of these books. The count is always changing because we're finding new manuscripts all the time, but probably around 2,500 right now of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Manuscripts are just defined as fragments or even full copies of books in the ancient world. Everybody counts them the same. You may not realize this, but there's archaeological digs going on all over the world right now, and they're always finding new copies of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There's a place in Egypt called Oxyrhynchus, which is a very strange name, I know. But Oxyrhynchus, Egypt, which of course doesn't exist anymore, it was an ancient city that they discovered. And when they discovered Oxyrhynchus, they actually discovered the rubbish heap where they dumped all the old manuscripts in. The sort of city garbage dump for manuscripts. Can you imagine finding that on an archaeological level? They found the Oxyrhynchus dump of manuscripts in the late 1800s, and there's been a consistent dig going on there for over 100 years. Every year, almost, they find a new copy of the canonical Gospels. And you know why you never hear about it? Because they're exactly the same as every other canonical Gospel that's ever been found. The wording is pretty much identical. And if you think if the wording was radically different, you think you would hear about it? Yeah, it'd be all over the news. But here's the thing. We have over 2,500, roughly, of the canonical Gospels floating around. How many do we have of, say, the Gospel of Thomas, of extant manuscripts? The answer is 3. That's a stunning fact. 3. In fact, only 3, and all of them are extremely fragmentary. Oxyrhynchus number 1, Oxyrhynchus 654, Oxyrhynchus 655 are the 3 Greek copies of the Gospel of Thomas. They are all very fragmentary, and that's all we have. In fact, every time Thomas is mentioned in the early church, it's condemned. And a lot of church fathers don't even mention it at all. What you have is no instance or no evidence that there is a popularity for these Gospels in the ancient world. In fact, on the contrary, what we basically think about these apocryphal Gospels, they're written for fringe groups. They're read behind the scenes, probably to entertain people. They're written for all kinds of reasons, but there is never any real basis for thinking that they played any major role in early Christianity. And where does that leave us? As we draw this to a close, that leaves us with a very clear answer, I think, to what's going on in the world around us. We talked at the very beginning about our world's love of diversity. And we talked about how that's played itself out in the historical world so that they think that early Christianity was diverse, and therefore there's a diversity of Gospels, and therefore pick whatever Gospel you like. Pick whatever Jesus you want. Here's an option. Pick Thomas, Philip, Mary, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You don't have just one. You have a bunch of choice. Diversity is the name of the game. But when you actually start looking at the historical facts behind it, you realize it just doesn't work that way. Now, people are still free to pick whatever Jesus they want. But they have to admit it might just be a fantasy Jesus. It might just be their own private Jesus. It might just be a made-up Jesus, which in effect is them picking themselves. But if you want the real Jesus, if you want the man who actually lived, if you want to know anything about him, and you want to be actually true, there's only one place that you can turn. And it's the place we've always turned. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Thank you very much.